Welcome to the MacArthur Memorial Podcast. Located in Norfolk, Virginia, the MacArthur Memorial is a museum and research center dedicated to the life and legacy of General of the Army Douglas MacArthur. The memorial is also dedicated to preserving and presenting the story of the millions of men and women who served with General MacArthur. Each month, the staff of the memorial will use this podcast to explore topics relating to General MacArthur and his times.
The following lecture by Walter Bornman, author of the book MacArthur at War, World War II in the Pacific, took place at the MacArthur Memorial's World War II Symposium in July 2016.
First off, we're going to have Walter Bornman. Walter made quite a nuisance of himself over the past couple of years, being here nonstop. Zobel, get me this. No, he really wasn't like that at all. Very nice guy. Very glad to have him. Professional writer. This is his book, MacArthur at War. You know, there's been a lot of books written on MacArthur. D. Clayton James did 3 volumes on it, and it usually took him about 10 pages just to get to one point. Manchester did a very famous book. It used to take him about 10 pages, and he never really got to the point. Walter has a way of synthesizing ideas and really getting to the essence of certain issues in just a few paragraphs, a few sentences. And that's really the strong point, I think, about Walter's book, very insightful about Douglas MacArthur. And so we will bring him up right now. So Walter Bornman from Colorado, welcome to the MacArthur Memorial.
Good morning. It is indeed a privilege to be here. I was going to say some nice things about Jim Zobel, and I think I still will after that introduction. I'm delighted to be back here. I really am. I would not have been able to do this book without the research facilities of this particular institution, and I thank it as an institution, and I certainly thank Jim Zobel as an individual personally for all the help. And I was going to allude, Jim, to the fact that maybe there were a few too many emails over the course of 3 or 4 years, but you offered gracious assistance always, and I greatly appreciate it. Well, MacArthur at War, World War II in the Pacific, is indeed just that. I really wanted to focus on MacArthur's evolution as a military commander during that 4-year period of time. Now, I think it goes without saying that the obvious is that there is no middle ground with Douglas MacArthur. There are people who revere him. There are people who despise him. And I think that that was probably true even during his lifetime. It's been amazing to me. This book has been out 10 weeks. And it's been amazing to me to travel around the country and see how much polarization there still is, 75 years after MacArthur in World War II, 50 years after the man's death. There's still a tremendous amount of polarization, either those people who are sure he was the greatest general of all time, or those people who, for almost nitpicky reasons all the way down, think that he was absolutely a terrible person and made no contribution. So having said that there's no middle ground with Douglas MacArthur, it might seem as a mission impossible for me to do what I tried to do, which was really talk about a very balanced and analytical approach to both the many, many good things that I think he did, particularly this whole idea of his evolution during this 4-year period of time as a military commander, and to talk about that as well as some of his more exasperating qualities. And those of you who know MacArthur know that there's no shortage of those kind of qualities. The adjectives used to describe him were never bland, whether they were superlatives of adulation or disdain. There's a lot out there. So what I tried to do is really, again, and thanks in large part to the research facility here, the ability to sort of think things through, talk to scholars in the field, and kind of get to the bottom of who MacArthur was. And I think that, let me just mention briefly two things that are themes, and then I really want to spend some time on this evolution as a military commander theme. One of the themes that's in the book that I really found fascinating is how does a man go from someone who is relatively well known, but certainly not known across the country, on December 7th of 1941, and then within 6 months, he's this absolute great American hero, a rallying cry for everything that's happening in the United States and the entire Allied world at that period of time. Well, I think there are a number of answers to that. One is certainly his ability to, in many respects, manage his own press. I think that there's also the situation you have that he's the only one during the first 6 months of 1942 who's really actively engaged with the Army. Now, the Navy's out there doing some things, but Ernest J. King, the Chief of Naval Operations, he's not one to publicize things. MacArthur's headquarters, on the other hand, are cranking out these communiques and press releases, and the American public really have their eyes on the Philippines. And I think that a final component of maybe how he makes this transformation to great American hero is that America, during these tenuous 6 months of 1942, really desperately need a hero. And, you know, this is absolutely the perfect setup. Americans wake up on December 8th of 1941. They've heard the news of Pearl Harbor. They're reeling from that. What is the first thing that happens in their mail on Monday morning, December 8th? Douglas MacArthur, by some just happenstance of fate, ends up on their doorstep on the cover of Life magazine, a very auditory article by Claire Booth Luce, and she really sets MacArthur up as this hero in the Far East. And again, the timing, just by coincidence, couldn't have been more amazing, but that's actually what happened on December 8th. The other theme that I tried to really get into in the book is explore this whole issue of Army-Navy controversy, rivalry, okay? And it certainly exists, because there are people on MacArthur's staff, like Sutherland and to some extent George Kenney, who are really just rabidly anti-Navy. But, you know, we were talking the last evening that sometimes I think that books come out, and I could think of a number in the recent past, that are really focused just on controversy and trying to really build it up. And if you read some of these things, you really kind of wonder at the end of the day, well, now, wait a minute. How did we ever win? How did these guys get together and really make things happen? And I would suggest to you that the truth of the matter is that MacArthur actually worked pretty well. Now, early on, you know, he's got his issues with Tommy Hart and the Asiatic Fleet in the fall of 1941. But I think he comes to work very well in what we're going to talk about at some length in terms of combined operation. I think he really does a great job of working with the Navy. And let me just throw out one thing as kind of an aside and give some of you historians in the room occasion to think about. Ernest J. King, the Chief of Naval Operations, imagine what would have happened if somebody else had been in that naval position and hadn't said, as King did, we are going to fight a two-ocean war. Because King said that, there's a tremendous amount of supplies and materiel that flow into the Pacific. Now, MacArthur would not have said that King was one of his strongest supporters or allies. But let me suggest to you that by promoting a two-ocean global war and pouring resources into the Pacific, like King and the Joint Chiefs did, that MacArthur is really a beneficiary of that kind of strategy. All right, so let's talk at some length about this evolution as a military command. And just in case there's some people new to MacArthur, here's the 60-second bio to get us to December 7th of 1941. He's definitely a 19th century man. I think that you need to remember that when you start with Douglas MacArthur. He's someone who's born in 1880. His father wins the Medal of Honor for a charge up Missionary Ridge in the Civil War. MacArthur goes on to West Point, graduates first, of course, in the class of 1903, does two tours in the Philippines. He ends up in the trenches of World War I. He's chief of staff and a brigade commander in the famed Rainbow Division. After the war, he's superintendent at West Point. And hey, here's an interesting fact. Did you know, since we're about to focus on the Olympics in Brazil, he's the head of the American delegation to the 1928 Olympics in Amsterdam. And in very, very typical MacArthur fashion, he tells the American team in Amsterdam, "Americans did not come here to lose." And America got the first place in terms of gold medals at the 1928 Games. So some people don't know that about MacArthur, his involvement with that. Athletics were always very important to the general. Well, by 1930, he's chief of staff for Herbert Hoover, and he stays on in that position for Franklin Roosevelt. 1935, he's done as being chief of staff, goes to the Philippines as military advisor. 1937, he's faced with the choice of being recalled to the United States. What's he going to do? I mean, he's still relatively young. He doesn't want to go back to being a corps commander. He's done that. He resigns from the Army, stays on in the Philippines as field marshal of the Philippine Army. And as Chris mentioned, he's basically recalled to active duty 75 years ago this month in the Philippines to become commander of U.S. forces in the Far East. So December 7th, it's December 8th in Manila time, 1941, MacArthur's woken in the morning by news of Pearl Harbor. And I think it's fair to say, when you look at him as a military commander, that he is simply overwhelmed, as are most commanders on the American side, by the speed and the complexity with which the Japanese bring the attack against the Philippines and, quite frankly, across all of the Pacific. It's not surprising that when we look at, and I'm going to give you just three examples of what I think are perhaps his biggest defeats and then three examples of his biggest victories, it's no surprise that when we look at that list of big defeats, that we start with Clark Field on December 8th of 1941. Now, you know, again, I'm fond of saying that sometimes history's shorthand doesn't get it right. I've gone around the last 10 weeks and talked to people, and the critics of MacArthur are always ready immediately to say, "Oh, yeah, MacArthur, he got caught with his planes on the ground at Clark Field." Well, yes, but those of you who know the story, it's far more complex than that in terms of what happens. Operationally, the American forces at Clark Field really account for themselves pretty well. They get the bombers and the fighters in the air, and of course the mistake they make is that when the second wave, the continuing wave of the Japanese attack is happening, they've landed and they've gone to lunch. So that definitely is a problem. But again, the shorthand of MacArthur got caught with his planes on the ground, not quite true. It's a much more complicated story than that. Second defeat, of course, is Bataan. The retreat to the peninsula, American and Filipino forces, and MacArthur's strategy has been, despite long years of what's called Plan Orange, the defense of just the area around Manila, MacArthur's strategy in the fall of 1941 evolves that he's going to be able to defend the entire archipelago, okay? So he spreads out men and supplies all over the islands, and of course the speed with which the Japanese attack really overwhelmed that. And by controlling the air, they really prohibit any kind of movement of supplies or things to Bataan. And I think what happens in terms of that is that MacArthur, again, is just almost blindsided by the speed with which the Japanese attack. And let me suggest to you that one thing about MacArthur is that he always worked on his own time. And he expected a Japanese attack at some point, but he thought it was going to come in the spring of 1942. And when it comes in December, in such a fury of land, air, and sea attack, again, I suggest that he's simply overwhelmed. The third topic defeat in terms of MacArthur's portfolio that I'd suggest to you, and Jim Duffy may talk a little bit more about this in terms of the New Guinea campaign, I think there needs to be a little scrutiny about whether or not he could have moved more quickly to reinforce Buna and basically prevent the entire New Guinea campaign back and forth across the Kokoda Trail. Now, to MacArthur's credit, he does that in terms of defending Milne Bay and being ready to repulse the Japanese invasion there. But it's an interesting period of time in July of 1942 there's a lot going on, and he doesn't have much resources. But it's still a situation where if he had been able to do that and able to really focus on the big picture of New Guinea, he might have been able to start from Buna rather than starting from Port Moresby and fast forward the war 6 months. So, I mean, for my take at least, there's three MacArthur defeats that by no small coincidence come very early in the war. Now, the three great victories that I'd suggest to you are his invasion of the Admiralties in March, late February, early March of 1944. It's ahead of schedule. It's a surprise. It completes the encirclement of Rabaul. And I think more importantly, it shows this thing combined operation. Today, we take air, land, and sea acting together for granted, okay? In 1941 and early 1942, particularly with MacArthur, this 19th century man, he's just not ready yet. He's got to be educated a little bit. He's got to evolve as a commander. And I think, again, much to his credit, he does. He embraces combined operations in all of those areas. And I just go on quickly to say that the other two victories from 44 that I would suggest are on the great list are certainly his leap across the north coast of New Guinea to Hollandia, and of course his invasion of Leyte and return to the Philippines. In all of those operations and those three great victories, combined operations is front and center. You know, we're going to talk a little bit too about MacArthur myths. And I think there's this myth that he was this great lone wolf, you know, the solitary strategist sitting there brooding. Well, you know, that made good press copy. And the photographs of him there puffing on a corncob pipe and reflecting, I mean, as I write in the book, no one's quite sure what he was thinking. Maybe he's thinking about strategy in the next day's operations. Maybe he's reminiscing about his father's charge up Missionary Ridge. Nonetheless, I suggest to you that when you peel back that myth of lone wolf, it is very much to MacArthur's credit that he has been able to put together a highly effective team that knows combined operations, knows their piece of that operations, and works together as a team. And we know the names. We'll just go through them briefly. It's Bob Eichelberger and Walter Kruger on land. It's Tom Kincaid and Dan Barbie with naval and amphibious operations. Take Barbie just as one example. This is a guy, Dan Barbie. His name was Uncle Dan, the amphibious man. And he goes to work for MacArthur. And the first couple assaults that he leads, my goodness, you know, there's a dozen landing craft and a couple of destroyers in 1943 off the coast of New Guinea. Contrast that 2 years later with 600 ships sitting out there in Leyte Gulf. It's amazing transition and implementation of America's industrial might and strength in only a short two-year period of time. And it's a testament to MacArthur's commander and MacArthur himself, who selected these commanders, that we have a situation where they're really able to bring to bear and manage that kind of increase in forces and, again, bring to bear combined operations. And, of course, you know, perhaps most important of all is George Kenney and his use of air power. We certainly have a situation with the Battle of the Bismarck Sea, March of 1943. And even prior to that, I think there's MacArthur saying, oh, yeah, you know, as chief of staff, I didn't really think too much in the 30s about air power. You know, he's on record as saying, well, I don't know if the Army really needs bombers. Then the Navy got bombers, so he needed some bombers too. But, it's a situation that by watching what Kenny does at the Battle of the Bismarck Sea, MacArthur really comes to embrace air power. And it really becomes an important part of all of his operation. In fact, Kenny is so focused on these early advances and these early raids that would go in and seize forward air bases for his fighters. You know the one time that they have problems with lack of air power because they make kind of a leap too far, if you will? It's the invasion of Leyte. Yes, they've got all kinds of carrier forces and that kind of support, but Kenny's got a hard time in the very beginning of really getting bases established on Leyte. Initially, he's only got two squadrons of P-38s there. So this is something that, you know, it's kind of an example to MacArthur that, hey, you know, the air power is very important, and we really always need that going forward. And, of course, the other couple of things that I point out, which really I think have to come under the umbrella of combined operations and under the umbrella of MacArthur evolving, of course, we're going to hear later today of the importance of Filipino guerrillas, that whole front that goes on and remains on the island. Sometimes we forget from the American side that there were a tremendous amount of Australian troops involved. I keep waiting, by the way. I keep waiting for some historian to write a review of my book and say, well, you know, for a Yank, Bornemann didn't do too bad a job of reminding folks that, oh, yes, the Australians were involved in Allies. And, of course, MacArthur's early operations in New Guinea, the bulk of those troops are indeed Australian troops. And the final element of combined operations really is ULTRA. The code-breaking operations, the kind of intelligence that permits George Kenny to find that Japanese convoy that's bound for Leh, make that kind of attack, and actually the attack and the leap to Hollandia, because of ULTRA, MacArthur knows where a lot of the concentration of Japanese forces is. So it's relatively, I don't want to use the term easy, but it's relatively telegraphed of what he needs to do in terms of going ahead and making that leap over the concentration of forces. And in retrospect, sometimes it's written about and looks like strategic genius, but it's really the fact that ULTRA has provided a lot of that information. Well, all right, so I think, suffice to say, that MacArthur really evolves during these 4 years as a commander. And I think it's a situation where, let's use the terms military commander and leader, and I don't necessarily use those synonymously. I think we've talked about the fact that MacArthur evolves on the tactical side as a military commander, embracing combined operations, embracing air power and those kind of elements, the whole amphibious operation. But I think he also comes to evolve as a leader. We can talk about in the questions, if you want, the whole characterizations of Dugout Doug, etc. But I think MacArthur is really a hands-on, lead-from-the-front man who, in World War I, certainly shows that. Why he didn't go to Bataan only one time during that terrible 90-day siege or so is, I don't think, something that is absolutely answerable. But the bottom line is that he goes from the "I shall return," and of course Franklin Roosevelt and George Marshall would have liked him to say, well, couldn't we say "we shall return"? No, that's not Douglas MacArthur. It was definitely "I shall return," and by doing that, that really galvanized American public opinion. "I shall return." But the early criticisms of him in terms of all of his communiques with I, and you know those many famous ditties about MacArthur's communiques, he really evolves with that too as the war goes on. And if you read some of his communiques, Leyte and Hollandia are examples, he almost goes on, it almost looks like movie credits by the time he credits not only the American field commanders, but the Australian field commanders as well. So I think he really does a good job of evolving with that, the whole idea of being back in the field. Now, you know, again, we can debate, was it really necessary for him to wade ashore at some of these places? No, probably not. He understood it was great showmanship. He understood it was great press. I think at some level he desperately wanted to kind of wipe out some of the Dugout Doug characterizations. But I think there's also an element of his that he really wanted to be with his troops. He really wanted to be in the field and see what happened. Kind of a parenthetical back to the whole idea of this command evolution of combined operations. It's command and control. How could he go ahead and basically do some of these operations and go off in the field, sometimes going off into radio silence for a couple of days, if he didn't have the kind of strong staff that he had not only picked but also delegated to? I think he would have found himself in deep trouble in terms of command and control if he didn't have that strong staff. So I emphasize that again to you. Well, let's look a little bit of some of the myths, if you will, about MacArthur. We've already talked about this lone wolf status and said that he's really not. He's got this great staff. The other component of that I think is important to remember is that he is always in a situation of receiving strategic directive from the Joint Chiefs. He's not out in the Pacific as the lone wolf deciding all by himself how we're going to defeat Japan. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, again, reference to Admiral King and George Marshall, really are the ones who are devising a global strategy. Now, just by the way, in the Pacific, of course, they can never decide through most of the course of the war whether the main line of attack across the Pacific is going to be Chester Nimitz and the Navy across the Central Pacific or Douglas MacArthur and mostly the Army in the Southwest Pacific. But be that as it may, the main directives are coming from the Joint Chiefs. But, and here's the but, I think MacArthur, to his credit, is definitely a good soldier at heart who is following orders and very effectively implementing those kind of directives. So as far as strategy, let's talk a little bit about island hopping, okay? Because that's kind of another MacArthur myth. There's this myth that he invented island hopping, a myth that he is the one who basically said we're going to circle and isolate Rabaul. Well, again, the truth of the matter is that island hopping is something that's, well, hey, we could even argue that the Japanese did their own form of island hopping when they leap over MacArthur and 80,000 American and Filipino troops on Bataan, okay, and basically isolate them rather than engaging head-to-head. So island hopping is something that Admiral Kincaid does in the Aleutians in 1943. It's something that Halsey undertakes about the same time in 1943 in the Solomons. And MacArthur comes to the concept relatively late in the game as he's thinking about how he makes up time and gets along the coast of New Guinea and gets back to the Philippines and, of course, ultimately attacks the home islands of Japan. So this is a situation that by 1944, the Joint Chiefs have made a decision that they're not going to attack Rabaul directly, that they're going to basically isolate it and send MacArthur along on his way on through the rest of New Guinea. And again, even if he's not the father of island hopping, and by the way, I think you maybe understand from my prior comments that I'm almost tempted, though, to call him the father of combined operations. Not quite, but pretty important in that regard. So he's not the father of island hopping, but when it comes to New Guinea and the attack on Hollandia and going on, he certainly embraces it. Now, the second part of that, of course, is does he always do that? The answer is no. We're going to hear about the campaigns this afternoon in the southern Philippines, Mindoro, and everything that goes on Mindanao. MacArthur's plans in 1945, quite frankly, by 1945, the spring of 1945, he's been so successful that the Joint Chiefs kind of just throw up their hands and say, okay, we've got this strategy of going back and obviously attacking the home islands of Japan. MacArthur's down there liberating all the southern Philippines, and now he's going into Borneo and wants to continue operations to the south. So it's the kind of thing that they almost kind of throw up their hands and say, okay, MacArthur's got all these resources, so we're just going to let him go and basically run with it. So again, the point of island hopping is that he does it very well when he chooses to do it. And I think that he really is a master and understands the concept of isolating an opponent's strength. Let's talk about low casualty rates. Another myth of MacArthur is that, you know, he accomplished more of everything with less of everything, and along the way incurred the lowest number of casualties. He said that repeatedly in his press releases. The casualty counts from the Pacific simply do not bear that out. In round figures, there's about 100,000, now we're just talking about American losses here, there's about 100,000 American casualties killed in action, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, in the Pacific in the Second World War. About 40% of those, 39,000, occur on the ground in MacArthur's theater. So again, the idea that he had the lowest casualty counts of any commander, some operations, that's true. But other operations, when we compare Buna to Guadalcanal, or when we compare things later on, Leyte and Bayak to other operations on Iwo Jima and Okinawa, the casualty rates are really pretty similar. Now, there's two famous incidences of MacArthur that critics usually point out to say, well, you know, the guy was really pretty callous about operations and things, and the way he valued human life. And of course, the two famous examples are him telling Bob Eichelberger, go to Buna, don't come back unless you take Buna. And also telling Eichelberger that, well, what do you mean? Your casualty counts don't look high enough. You haven't been engaged heavily enough. And of course, he has a similar conversation in early 1945 on Luzon when he's bound and determined to advance against Manila. So it's true, he tells Kruger that, well, again, you don't seem to have big enough casualty counts. What's going on with the advance? You need to press the attack a little bit more heavily. Those are two examples that usually are thrown up as criticism that MacArthur really didn't care about troops. Let me suggest to you, and Jim Duffy's going to show you a photo of this in a little bit. There's a great photo of MacArthur and Kenny on the tarmac in New Guinea getting ready to launch the paratrooper assault against NADZAB. And with him is Colonel John Jarvis Tolson, who's commander of the 503rd Parachute Regiment. Look at MacArthur's face when that comes up a little bit later on the screen. Look at the way MacArthur has his hand on Tolson's sleeve. Let me suggest to you that MacArthur realized that he needed to expend lives, most regrettably, but it needs to be done in war in order to accomplish objectives. But I think that at his heart, he really did have a lot of empathy for his troops and the men that he was sending into harm's way. And I would just point out, Jim Zobel, I don't know if you did this on purpose, but Jim's book, in terms of photographs and everything, when I got that and looked through it, I was struck that a lot of those photographs show MacArthur in a very engaged, caring discussion with engaged, caring look on his face, talking to the men that, again, he's sending into harm's way. Now, you know, that's not to say that there's a little bit of dichotomy sometimes when MacArthur would show up with his khaki gloves and his pressed uniform and everything, and wade ashore and talk to people who hadn't had a shower in a couple of weeks or even a good meal in a couple of weeks, splattered with mud and everything else. So there wasn't always was a great camaraderie between troops in the field and MacArthur. They were just different personalities. But I would suggest to you at the end of the day, my research would show that the whole idea that MacArthur didn't care or was callous about an expenditure of lives just is not true. But let me tell you the final story about a myth that really makes me pull my hair out, okay? This is one thing that I think it's very difficult to defend Douglas MacArthur on. And that's his continuing discussion, his continuing rants, if you will, that one, he is always short of supply, okay? And number two, he's always short of men. And finally, that somehow the powers that be in Washington are out to get him. I just don't think it's true. Even in the Philippines, in the fall of 1941, MacArthur has been saying, look, I can defend all the islands. Send me everything you've got. On the morning of December 8th in Manila, 1941, MacArthur's got more B-17 bombers in Manila out at Clark Field than are in the entire Philippines. Okay, we've all seen the movie Tora 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 many times. The famous B-17s that fly into Pearl Harbor during the attack, they're supposed to continue on to MacArthur. So again, with limited resources, George Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, and Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1941 are pushing all kinds of, and I document the increase in terms of the number of men, but also in terms of the materiel and planes and everything that go into the Philippines. He really is getting the lion's share of what's going into the Pacific. And I think that continues for some period of time. The whole idea that he didn't have political support in Washington, of course, there's three usual suspects, if you will, that MacArthur and people on his staff are always sure who are out to get him, okay? And they're the obvious three suspects, Franklin Roosevelt, George Marshall, and Dwight Eisenhower. Now, you remember that Dwight Eisenhower, at this point, early in 1942, still working for George Marshall as assistant and then chief of the War Plans Division. So it's really up to Eisenhower to try to figure out, you know, how are they going to reinforce the Philippines? And both Marshall and Franklin Roosevelt really have a commitment to do that. And as the war goes on, and there are more and more people, there are more and more supplies and everything that go into the Southwest Pacific Theater, at one point, Marshall, in January of 1944, has got to write MacArthur and say, would you please hurry up and unload these supply ships? You're clogging the pipeline. This is at Milne Bay, and they've got dozens and dozens of ships there waiting to be unloaded. MacArthur, through all of this, this great buildup of America's industrial strength, MacArthur, through all of this, is basically saying, oh, I'm operating on a shoestring. I need more stuff. I need more material and supplies. So I understand that it's the duty of a field commander to lobby for more resources to get the job done. But let me suggest to you that I think that MacArthur took that to the absolute extreme. And there's an element of paranoia in his personality, not very flattering when we compare it to some of the more positive things, but there's an element there that he just could not embrace the fact that he was getting not only political support, but also military support. And certainly, again, in the questions, if you wish, we could talk about his relationship with Franklin Roosevelt and the whole 44 presidential campaign and things like that. And Marshall, Roosevelt, and Eisenhower would never be signaled out as people who were huge MacArthur fans. But the truth of the matter is that they did support him, and there was a lot of material that went into the Southwest Pacific. All right. Let me tell you the story that I think really emphasizes. We have a situation where it is December of 1943. It's the Cairo-Tehran conferences. George Marshall and Roosevelt and the Joint Chiefs are in Cairo. Marshall could well have simply flown from Cairo westward back to the United States. He doesn't. He decides to go the other way and visit both MacArthur in New Guinea and Halsey in the Solomons. Now, actually, it's kind of an interesting story about this plane trip. It's a C-54 that the man who becomes Sutherland and MacArthur's pilot, Weldon Dusty was his nickname, Rhodes, is actually at the controls. The co-pilot's sicker than a dog on the cockpit floor. The guy in the co-pilot seat is Sutherland, MacArthur's chief of staff, who actually did a fair amount of flying. Okay? So they take off from Cairo, and they're flying eastward into Pakistan. And, you know, it's pretty dicey. It's not a regular route. There's lightning flashing all around. They get into a big storm. Rhodes is there kind of checking the map, and all of a sudden lightning flashes and exposes these huge towering mountain ranges on both sides of the plain. Takes another look at this map, French map. Oh, elevations are in meters, not feet. Maybe we better pull back on the yoke just a little bit. Quick 180 and out of there. But I mean, that's how dangerous the trip was. That's the point of the story. That's how dangerous Marshall's trip was. And imagine, because Wiedemeyer is on that plane, he's going to become chief of staff to Mountbatten in India. And of course, Sutherland's on the plane as MacArthur's chief of staff and Marshall. So there, if that plane had gone down, that could have been huge in terms of the American war effort. And I tell you that story, again, to emphasize how dangerous it was. So the plane goes on, and it lands in India, and then eventually gets to Australia. Well, MacArthur has been criticized for not being there in Brisbane to welcome George Marshall, his boss, as chief of staff. MacArthur is out on Good Enough Island, and Jim's going to show you a picture of this, too, in a little bit. And he's out on Good Enough Island planning the invasion of New Britain and the Gloucester landings in December of 1943. Now, again, it just shows that those people who are on the side of being absolute, no-holds-bar MacArthur critics will go to any extreme to put the worst possible light on something. And in this case, the story is that, well, MacArthur just absolutely shunned Marshall, and, you know, he went to hide out on Good Enough Island, didn't want to invite. Well, Marshall didn't feel that way, okay? And I suggest to you, and I write in the book, that I think Marshall gets a lot better idea of what's going on in the Southwest Pacific by flying to Good Enough Island, by meeting with MacArthur and his combined operations staff there, than he would have by being in Brisbane for a day or two in some hotel room. So from Marshall's standpoint, and many, many times, I would think that George Marshall is sort of the salt of the earth in terms of managing his commanders. Marshall really goes and I think makes this effort, pretty complicated and, as I pointed out, dangerous effort, to say to MacArthur, we support, we Washington political establishment and military high command, we support what you're doing here. And he makes a similar stop with Halsey in the Solomons as he goes on. MacArthur, on the other hand, says, and let me just read you what he writes after that. MacArthur says, probably no commander in American history has been so poorly supported. At times it looked as though it was intended that I should be defeated. How can you write that? The only thing more disingenuous was MacArthur's assertion that he had, quote, absolutely no contacts in the United States, despite almost daily messages with Marshall and the War Department. MacArthur said, and again I quote from one of his letters, his opinions were rarely sought and my advice on important matters given little consideration. Here's his final line. My isolation is complete. Again, for all I point out about his good things, his military acumen and combined operations, it's just almost crazy to me to use that term, that he can't accept that people are supporting him. George Marshall has just flown halfway around the world to prove it. And by the way, George Marshall dispatches high-ranking, George Lincoln is a brigadier general who does it after the Yalta conference, but after each of the major global planning conferences, Marshall sees that a high-level officer on Marshall's staff goes to wherever MacArthur is and delivers the talk. And gives the report in terms of what's happened. Okay, final story, Jim. People ask me, well, do you have a favorite MacArthur story? And the first time I asked, got that question, I'm kind of like, well, I wrote about the 4 5-star admirals. I usually have a story that kind of encapsulates each of their personality and draws a chuckle as well. But I don't really have a story like that about MacArthur. And I think that's in part because how complex a man on all sides of the compass he was. So let me give you my MacArthur story and just let you ponder it. There's no punchline, and it's not a humorous story. It's the second day of the PT boat escape from Corregidor. They're waiting it out on an island. Japanese troops may appear, naval forces, aircraft at any time. It's hot. MacArthur's 62 years old. That's old by the standards of the time. He's worried about his young wife. He's worried about little Arthur. This is not the way he intended his tenure in the Philippines to end. He doesn't know what's going to happen. And again, let me suggest to you, and let me suggest particularly to MacArthur's critics, that I think they would do well to look at that particular moment. Because I think on that hot desert island, late that day, as the sun scorched and they had to decide whether they're going to make another run at night, try to wait for a submarine, or whatever they were going to do, late on that afternoon, MacArthur really reaches into the depth of his personality and finds a steely resolve that really leads him forward through the course of the war. And I think it accentuates both his more positive, better quality. I think it also accentuates some of his leadership, some of his weaknesses. But on both sides, evolving as a leader and perhaps being exasperating on a few of the things that we've talked about, I think that moment is a pretty defining time. So where then does Douglas MacArthur stand 3/4 of a century from the 4-year period of both his greatest triumphs and his defeats? On September 2nd, 1945, after 4 years at war, one thing was certain about Douglas MacArthur and his place in history. His rhetoric, however hyperbolic at times, and his characterization of events, however overstated and embellished his facts sometimes, had nonetheless served to generate an enormous rallying cry for the American and Australian people in the dark days of 1942. Responsible though he was for much of the debacle in the Philippines, he had miraculously escaped on presidential orders, and the great majority of the Allied world was left with no doubt that he would return. He was their inspiration, their rallying point, and their synonym for victory. MacArthur acknowledged one American commentator early in 1944, quote, provided his countrymen with a badly needed idol at a time when the military altar was almost bare of icons. And the American people continued to embrace him even as other heroes joined him on the altar. Asked in March 1945 to name the greatest American general of the war, 43% chose MacArthur. Eisenhower came in second with 31%. Patton was third with 17%. MacArthur always carried with him an indomitable will to win. It was ingrained in his gene. It was his most laudable quality. There is, as he would go on to say, no substitute for victory. A concept, by the way, that I think was much, much clearer in World War II than it would become even 5 short years later in Korea. He fit the times perfectly. Douglas MacArthur's most important contribution in history was to be the hero who rallied America and its allies when they were at low ebb, and to become the symbol of determined resolve so desperately needed in the grim days of 1942. It was a role of a lifetime, and he played it brilliantly. He was MacArthur at war. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact Amanda Williams at amanda.williams@norfolk.gov.